From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Attorney General Maura Healey is taking e-cigarette maker Juul to court, saying the company addicted an entire generation to nicotine.
You cannot profit off of the addictions of young people without consequence. We're suing Juul.
Also today, we break down the results of the New Hampshire primary.
This victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
And Jan Brett, Massachusetts native and popular children's book author and illustrator, shares her thoughts on what makes a children's book special.
If children don't feel like there is some kind of grit and importance in the writing, they don't know it, but they can feel it.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Attorney General Maura Healey is suing the e-cigarette retailer Juul. She announced the suit earlier today, and she's on the line now to tell us why. Attorney General Healey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, good to be with you.
So why are you suing Juul?
Well, Juul's a company that made billions of dollars from getting kids addicted, and specifically getting kids addicted to e-cigarettes. We filed a lawsuit this morning against Juul following an extensive investigation that showed from the outset, from the time Juul came to market in 2015, it launched with the intention of targeting young people. They wanted to create a new class of users, and they launched with a really extensive campaign that used everything from celebrities to social media influencers. They were purchasing ad space on websites for kids, actually. And we also uncovered that the fact that they were selling and shipping e-cigarettes to kids who were underage in Massachusetts.
So we took them to court. So you launched this investigation. There's been some other reporting and other lawsuits, like one in California, alleging that Juul marketed to minors. What new did you learn about Juul's practices in your investigation?
Well, a lot is new. First of all, we learned for the very first time that Juul hired a ad company that created one set of ads directed at an older audience and then rejected that and used instead another ad campaign that was directed exclusively towards young people. Juul, we learned, went about recruiting fashion role models, people who influence young people. They targeted these celebrities. They targeted ads using these celebrities in their ads, and the ads themselves were placed on websites that were meant for kids. No other investigation has uncovered in this much detail the evidence we have showing that Juul systematically and very intentionally targeted young people in its advertising. And sadly, their efforts worked, because today in Massachusetts, one in three Massachusetts high schoolers have used an e-cigarette, probably a Juul, in the past month. Teenagers right now in our state are 16 times more likely to be Juul users than people even in their 20s. So I think most parents, school administrators, medical professionals understand that this is a public health crisis we're doing. And today we called out Juul based on our investigation, because they are the company that created this market, and they are the entity that needs to be held accountable.
So in a statement to WBUR, Juul said that they're working, quote, on earning the trust of society. They also said that they stopped the sale of most flavored pods, halted all TV, print, and digital advertising, did more to curb underage use of their products. They emphasize that their customer base is a billion adult smokers, and they, quote, do not intend to attract underage users, end quote. Have they made positive steps forward to combat youth vaping? These are steps they're taking.
No, absolutely not. And in fact, you know, here's what's really troubling. We uncovered in an email that a Juul customer service representative was writing back and forth to a teenager here in Massachusetts. And that customer, that Juul employee, was telling that teenager how to order and where to have it shipped to in Massachusetts so he could get around the age verification law. So that's just an example of many examples that show just how intent Juul was at creating this market for young people. Again, at the very beginning, Juul designed this to attract and appeal to young people. That has continued. And really, you know, so much damage has been done as you think about, you know, what's happened to kids and families around the state. And that's why we took the strong action that we've taken. Juul needs to stop advertising and selling its products to kids. And if Juul can't do that, then they shouldn't be operating in our state.
Attorney General Healey, you said earlier today that Juul got, quote, an entire generation, end quote, addicted to nicotine. That is a lot to put on one company. They are not the only e-cigarette manufacturer out there.
Well, that's true, but Juul controls 75% of the market. And remember, Juul's a company that's now owned 35% by Altria, the formerly known as Philip Morris. And basically, they've ripped a page from Big Tobacco. Juul has 75% of the market. There are other entities out there. In fact, I've sued them to shut down their bad practices, most recently suing 8 companies that were illegally selling online over the Internet to kids here in Massachusetts. But Juul created this whole epidemic and, you know, as I say, today controls 75% of the market.
So
they need to be held accountable for what they have done and how they've looked to exploit the health and well-being of our young people.
Let's talk about that, because you did sue some other companies, including Eon Smoke, for marketing and selling nicotine vaping products to minors. And you have detailed that there were stores in Massachusetts that we know were illegally selling to minors. This sounds like a vertical structural set of failures or breakdowns on multiple levels, not just with one company.
Well, I guess there were failures with different companies and stores out there. However, no one has the failures along the lines of Juul. When you talk about retail stores, I'll tell you what Juul did. Juul was going into retail stores here in Massachusetts and identifying which stores were selling to underage kids. Did they report it? Did they shut them down? Did they stop shipping product to those stores? No. They continued. And as I say, Juul was the first to come to market in 2015 with a campaign focused on young people. The result here in Massachusetts and, frankly, all across this country is that we have young people who would never have picked up a regular cigarette, now juuling and vaping. And, you know, it's so sad. I talk to so many parents and families. You've got kids who are getting disciplined in school, suspended, getting kicked off sports teams, and really struggling with addiction issues that they need treatment for today. And that's just sad. And it's particularly sad and galling when you know it was calculated and intentional on the part of a few executives looking to make a boatload of money pretty quickly.
So let me
and
just...
they did a very successful job doing just that. Juul executives took home, Juul as a company took home $3.3 billion in 1 year alone.
Let me just jump in here. I do want to ask you, why do this now? The FDA is investigating e-cigarette companies for marketing to minors. There have been other lawsuits, like a lawsuit in California against Juul. Why does Massachusetts need to bring its own lawsuit now?
Because nobody's brought the lawsuit that we've brought. First off, FDA hasn't done anything. FDA's been asleep at the switch the whole time. The other lawsuits, I commend my other states for the lawsuits they brought, but nobody actually did the investigation that they did, that we did, and we've told the story in really extensive detail with emails, documents, ads, and we took a lot of depositions and testimony from employees, former employees, I should say, under oath. And so that's why this action is being brought now, because it's the result of an extensive investigation, and we feel very confident about pursuing Juul in court. In the meantime, I hope that, you know, all of us have a better understanding of exactly what this company did as a result of our telling the story and explaining that in our complaint filed here today in Massachusetts State Superior Court.
Just briefly, Attorney General, Dr. Michael Siegel is a researcher and professor at Boston University School of Public Health. He said he was disturbed by the allegations you detailed in your lawsuit about young smokers today, but he has been an advocate for adult use of these products as a way to stop smoking cigarettes. Any concern that if you go after Juul in this way, you're cutting off an avenue for adult smokers who may find this a safer and more viable alternative to combustible cigarettes?
Yeah, you know, this really isn't about smoking cessation, and Juul was not about getting adults to stop smoking. It was about getting kids to start vaping. And, you know, if you really want to look at the science of this, Juul delivers nicotine at a far greater punch than a regular cigarette. And, you know, we adults can make the decisions that they need to make for themselves, but we're not going to stand by as an attorney general's office and let our young people get poisoned, let them get addicted, and let them be taken advantage of in this way. And so I think that, you know, the entire health profession, medical profession, the pediatricians that we work with, you know, everyone is squarely on the side of recognizing this as a public health crisis, and the fact that companies like Juul need to be held accountable and need to stop doing things that hurt young people.
That is Attorney General Maura Healey. Attorney General, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Hey, great to be with you.
Listening with us here in the studio is WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zeninger Enwemeka, who's been following this story. Hey there, Zeninger.
Hi.
So let me just ask you your reactions to what you just heard. Did you hear anything different from the Attorney General this afternoon than you heard this morning?
What I heard was Healey really doubling down on her announcement this morning. I mean, she's really taking aim at Juul here. She sees this company as basically ground zero for the teen vaping epidemic, the catalyst, if you will. Now, as you mentioned in your question to her, that there are other vape companies, but Juul really is the largest. And we've even seen tobacco companies buying a stake in Juul. So somewhat of an indication that even cigarette manufacturers are seeing how popular vaping has become.
You heard the Attorney General say to me that this lawsuit is different. Nobody's brought the lawsuit that Massachusetts is bringing, but there have been other lawsuits. How significant do you think this one is, and how big of an impact do you think it could have?
It will certainly have an impact in Massachusetts. I mean, Juul has faced several lawsuits from school districts, from public health organizations, other states. This lawsuit will have more of a direct impact on folks in Massachusetts. You know, Healey is really seeking money and damages for the people who have been hurt by Juul's practices. And she mentioned that statistic of 1 in 3 high school students in Massachusetts using e-cigarettes in the past month. And that is really what her focus is trying to get some sort of recourse for those individuals.
So you were at her press conference today. Have you heard any responses to the lawsuit in the last couple hours?
Yes. Well, at that same press conference, Healey was flanked by several public health advocates, even a group of teens who have been impacted by vaping as she announced this lawsuit this morning. I spoke with Emma Tigerman, who was at the press conference. She's 19 and has struggled with an addiction to vaping. She says it's everywhere.
It was just accessible as someone who is youthful. There were dealers that were, you know, illegally distributing it within my school even, and also through smoke shops. And it was the new trend. It was almost like owning an iPhone.
Quite the statement there. And, you know, those in the public health space are also reacting to this lawsuit. You referenced Dr. Michael Siegel, yeah, a researcher and professor at Boston University School of Public Health. He says he knew Juul's products were popular with minors, but it was possible that that was due to some sort of organic marketing. But he says these allegations bring this to a whole new level.
That kind of sets a very different picture than this just being something where, you know, it just kind of became popular among youth without the company really knowing about it or playing any role. So I think that these allegations are really disturbing.
So in our last few seconds here, Zeninger, what comes next?
Well, we should expect to hear more from Juul and see how they respond to this case. We'll sort of have to wait and see how the lawsuit moves forward and if there's a settlement reached. I'll also throw out an interesting note here is that Healey's predecessor, Martha Coakley, works at Juul. And I would be very interested and curious to see if there's any statement or comment that she has there.
Well, we'll keep watching it with you. That's WBUR's Zeninger Enwemeka. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Pretty dramatic New Hampshire Democratic primary last night with victory for Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and with former Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar celebrating their own strong results.
This victory here is the beginning of the end for Donald Trump.
One day, books will tell not just of one election, but of the era that began with you here in New Hampshire. Thank you.
As everyone had counted us out, even a week ago, thank you, pundits, I came back and we delivered.
Meanwhile, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren pointed to the future.
We still have 98% of our delegates for our nomination up for grabs. And Americans in every part of the country are going to make their voices heard.
And from former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, something a little different.
We feel as tired as you. And Diane and I are going to go home and rest and reflect on this outcome and make some decisions tomorrow morning about what the future of this campaign can and should be.
Well, tomorrow morning came, and just hours ago, Patrick sent a letter to his supporters saying he was suspending his campaign after winning less than 0.5% of the vote in New Hampshire. Joining us now from outside Peterborough, New Hampshire, is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tiziana.
I know it was a long night. Did you get some sleep?
I got a few hours sleep, but I'm here to tell you that, you know, after Iowa, it's really interesting to be able to sit and talk about real results following an election.
I bet. And we're going to do that, too, with here in Studio 3, former Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano. Thanks for being with us, Congressman.
As always, it's a pleasure.
And we're going to do it with you. We want you to call us. What did you think of the primary results? Were you in New Hampshire to vote yesterday, to canvass? Were you watching from Massachusetts? Tell us what's on your mind. Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Anthony, I'm going to start with you. I want to get your reaction to Deval Patrick's decision to drop out. Any surprise to you at all on that today?
No, it's no surprise. I mean, it sort of makes me sad only in that, you know, Deval Patrick is such a talented politician. I covered him when he was governor. You know, he ran a terrific grassroots campaign, his first campaign when he was elected in Massachusetts. And he has real political talent. And it's interesting to imagine what it might have been like if he could have gotten into the race a year earlier, which is when he wanted to get into the race.
Remind us why he didn't. Yeah,
his wife had cancer, and so he had to step back and obviously attend to her. A year later, she was cancer-free, and he jumped in, and it was just too late. It was just too steep a hill to climb. But even he knew it. I mean, when he got in, he admitted that his late entry into the campaign was a Hail Mary from two stadiums over. So I don't think he went into this thinking he had, you know, a great chance of doing it. But
so,
clearly,
Anthony,
he had to get out. Yeah.
Why do you think he did it?
I think he genuinely, I take him at his word. I mean, I think he wanted to do it, and I think he believed that there was a path because, as he said, a lot of people had been running for president for over a year, and no one had yet closed the deal. And in a way, the result out of New Hampshire sort of validated that point of view. It's still a very muddled race, and he thought there was a lane for someone who could unite the party, bring the moderates together, offer a credible alternative to the kind of hard left Bernie Sanders and others. You know, he's someone who talks about.
You know, Anthony, I'm losing you a little bit at the quality of the connections. I'm going to take a second and turn to Congressman Capuano for reaction, and we'll reconnect. What's your thought about Deval Patrick's announcement today?
I think everything Anthony said is right. Gave it a shot. Wasn't going to work out. I give him credit for taking a shot. I also give him credit for reading the numbers and taking a tough decision.
Was there ever a path for him, do you think, Congressman?
In hindsight, it's easy to see no. But at the time, I don't think anybody would have drawn the election the way we've had it now. No one would have drawn the election of the Republican side 4 years ago. So it's always worth a shot. I respect everybody who steps into the arena, particularly Deval. He knew what he was getting into, and he knew how difficult it was. But I think it deserves our respect.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. What do you think of the performance of our various New England representatives in the New Hampshire Democratic primary last night? Did you vote? Are you looking ahead to Super Tuesday when we vote here in Massachusetts? Tell us what's on your mind. So let's turn to last night's results. Anthony, do we have you back?
I think so, but
excellent.
You tell me.
Yeah, there you go. So let's just start with Bernie Sanders. He came out on top with 25.7% of the vote, narrowly beating Pete Buttigieg, who got 24.4% of the vote, with just shy of 100% of the precincts reporting. Anthony, is Sanders now the clear front runner?
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, I think that makes clear that he's the front runner. It was a far cry from the 60% he got 4 years ago. But look, a win is a win. Give him credit. He won in New Hampshire. He worked hard for it. And, he probably won the popular vote in Iowa, though we're still waiting for official results there. So those are two big wins for him in a row. And, yeah, I think he managed to consolidate the progressive vote. And he's the clear front runner.
Congressman,
no question about it.
What do you think the party's reaction to that is?
And you say the party? So you're talking to Congressman?
Yeah, I'm going to ask Congressman Capuano here.
I don't know. I mean, the party is not this monolithic entity sitting in a corner making decisions like that. I think every Democrat I know is sitting back and wondering. I think I have to respectfully disagree with Anthony. I don't think Bernie Sanders or anybody is a clear front runner at the moment. Congratulations for the two victories. I think it would have been a real shot to the gut if Bernie had not won last night. It is not unnoticed that he got significantly fewer votes than he got 4 years ago. And as I've said for quite a while now, I don't think anything is going to really matter until March 3rd.
So, Anthony, some Sanders supporters, you maybe heard some of this at his victory party last night, are actually saying, all respect to you, Congressman, if anybody else had made the showing that Bernie Sanders made last night, there wouldn't be any question of whether he's the front runner. It's because it's Bernie Sanders that people question that. Is that something you've heard, Anthony?
No, I didn't hear that. And I actually want to agree with Mike, what he said. I mean, when I say he's the clear front runner, what I mean is there's nobody else at this point who has done what he's done.
Totally agree.
I mean, to take Mike's point, look, if you add up all of the progressive vote, if you add up Warren and Sanders votes and compare them to the total number of moderate votes, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, the moderates far outnumbered the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren's vote. So that sort of tells you that Bernie Sanders doesn't have this lockdown yet. And that's one of the big questions going forward. You know, the critics of Sanders say he's got this ceiling. You know, he got about 24-25% in Iowa. He got 26% in New Hampshire. Can he go higher than that? And right now he's benefiting from a very fractured moderate vote. So in that sense, I definitely agree with the congressman.
Well, let's talk about that moderate vote. Here you have Pete Buttigieg, former mayor of a small city in Indiana, 2 years ago, no name recognition, roundly beating a popular former vice president last night, kind of breathing down the neck of first place. Now, Congressman, is this momentum that's starting for Pete Buttigieg Anthony just referred to Sanders as potentially having a ceiling? Is there a ceiling for Pete Buttigieg or do we just not know?
Unknown. I mean, I think it shouldn't be lost on people, that, especially when it comes to president and maybe governors, to not have much experience in the place you want to go has actually been a positive for many, many years. There are very few people that have a lot of experience that ever make it into the White House. Why that is, I'll leave that to the sociologists and political pundit types. But it's true. You don't get the, quote, inside candidate getting elected very often. Hillary Clinton might have been the exception to that rule, but she had a very difficult time doing it, and she didn't win in the end. Donald Trump was the outside candidate. All that being said, I think that's part of the Biden problem. And I think that people are still looking to see who the alternative is they want. Certainly Buttigieg is in that mix, and he's done very well. We'll have to wait and see whether it lasts.
So let's take a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, to join the conversation with Jeremy in Barnstable, Massachusetts. What do you want to say to our panelists, Jeremy?
Hi. I'm a teacher, high school teacher, so I was up doing some election tourism yesterday and on Monday, and I was at a couple of the events. The Amy Klobuchar, I think that seemed to be the candidate that a lot of people were talking about, and a lot of people saying, hey, she really impressed me. She's someone that I want to look more at. And I think with her, we saw with the results that her, star is rising. And I think the question that I have, and I think that a lot of other people might have, is does she have that national network that's going to be able to push her to compete a bit more?
Great question. Let's turn that to Anthony.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the question. Well, first of all, in terms of the caller's observation about New Hampshire, he's absolutely right. I was up here last week, and there was definitely a buzz. Klobuchar had sort of caught that sort of tip of that wave right at the right time going into the New Hampshire primary. She did super well Biden. It impressed a lot of voters, and a lot of people were talking about her. She was, her events were really well attended. But yeah, the big question is, does she have a lot of money? No. Does she have a big national organization? No. I heard a great, I can't remember who said it, I just heard it this morning, but someone sort of described Klobuchar as basically, you know, building a plane in flight. You know, that's what she has to do. She, because the calendar is going to start speeding up really quickly. And there isn't a lot of time to sort of build up that campaign. But there's nothing like winning to sort of, you know, bring in the dollars and get people excited. And she's definitely poised to move forward in that way. But there are some questions.
Congressman, do you think she can get a big enough bounce out of New Hampshire to sort of fill some of these deficits in team and staff and presence and money, et cetera?
Tough question. I've been watching this campaign this year, and been watching it for a long time, and it's hard to tell whether this is simply the flavor of the week or not. I mean, we've done this already just in this cycle with Buttigieg and Warren and Sanders and Biden. Everybody's had their opportunity. Now it's Amy's time, and it might hold. Again, her timing on this was much better than the other people's timing. But there is a fair question as to whether she can replicate this on Super Tuesday. I'm told that she has very little, if any, organization in any of those states. And that day is going to elect one-third of all the delegates in one day. And we got Mike Bloomberg ready to pounce. I don't know what all this means. I think it's a fair question. And again, like I said, I think we got next Saturday we'll have Nevada. It'll be interesting to see who does what there. Heavily unionized, a little bit more of a diverse state. And then South Carolina. So, but in the meantime, I still think this is mostly, especially this year, it's going to be a sideshow to Super Tuesday. That's really going to, I think, going to make a much big decisions.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join our conversation. Holly's on the line from Lincoln. Holly, you're on with our panelists. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to follow up with a question and something I've been reading all morning, which is why the media continues to say that Bernie is a clear front runner. I know that the count is still, you know, undecided yet in Iowa, but it seems that Pete Buttigieg got the delegate vote. And as far as New Hampshire, Bernie clearly won, but it wasn't a runaway win. It was a very close win, something that he should have run away with. And Pete Buttigieg had an extremely strong showing in that state. I almost feel like the media is kind of driving a narrative that the facts don't yet bear out. Perhaps they will in
all right,
our state.
Let's give that to our senior political correspondent, Holly. Thanks for that call, Anthony.
No. You know, guilty as charged. I made the statement a short while ago that he's the clear front runner. I guess there is a sense that in this very fractured campaign, you have sort of two sets of candidates. You've got the progressives on the left. You've got Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and Sanders seems to have taken a lot of that progressive sort of energy away from Elizabeth Warren and managed to coalesce that progressive vote. And with that, he won Iowa, won New Hampshire. So in this very early moment in the campaign, I think it's fair to say, compared to all the rest of the campaigns, he's the front runner. But you've got to listen to what Mike Capuano said. I mean, you know, we're very early, and what's going to happen in a very short amount of time is we're going to roll into Nevada, Carolina, and then Super Tuesday.
So, Anthony, I'm losing you again. I'm going to turn to Congressman Capuano, and I want to pick up on something Anthony said. He mentioned Elizabeth Warren. You know, she made the argument, hey, this is, you know, just two states down. There's 55 states and territories to go. At the same time, she's a senator from Massachusetts. What do you think explains her poor showing in New Hampshire, which is a neighboring state?
I don't know. I mean, I think Anthony has it right. I think right now the party is still going through this left-middle dichotomy and people struggling with how far left they want to go. James Carville had some very interesting things to say about that a couple of days ago. I do think that it looks like today that Bernie has kind of solidified himself with the more progressive wing of the party. Is it enough? And Again, when you're talking two small states that are overwhelmingly white and relatively monolithic, it's hard to judge that. Again, Nevada is a little bit more diverse. South Carolina offers a different type of diversity. Super Tuesday will be telling us all, will answer, I won't say all the questions, but it'll answer a lot. There'll be very few people left standing after that.
So that's the day. It sounds like what you're saying is, you know, it's still a lot of uncertainty, a lot of churn in this mix. But it sounds like you're saying come March 4th, basically, we're going to have a pretty good sense of what's going on.
And I think we'll lose one or two or three candidates after that. I don't know who they'll be, and I don't know, you know, exactly how long they might want to hang on. But if they're not out, they will be effectively out by then.
All right, let's grab another call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Jane on the line from Arlington. Jane, go ahead.
Sure. My question for the panelists, my current angst for today, should Michael Bloomberg actually buy his way or win the nomination, do you think Bernie supporters would go out and vote for him, or will they stay home again?
That's an interesting question. Let me turn to you on that, Congressman.
I have no idea. I can't imagine they're going to stay home again. I would hope that if nothing else taught people a lesson, it was the election of Donald Trump. We don't get to vote for who we love in a candidate, and more often than not, we get to vote for the best of the people who are running. And if the choice, again, James Carville had, I think, a great quote. He's not a Bernie Sanders supporter. He said something like, I will vote for the fanatical socialist every single time over the career criminal. And I think that's pretty succinct and pretty direct and maybe a little hard-edged, but I can't imagine anybody who would support Bernie Sanders not coming to the same conclusion. They can be angry, they can be upset, they can be disappointed, and I respect all of that. But when this final bell is rung, it's going to be Donald Trump versus somebody, and any of the candidates that are currently in there now, I have problems with some of them, just like everybody else does. There isn't a one of them who comes anywhere near close to my degree of problems with Donald Trump.
And I do want to note, there was a Republican primary last night. Donald Trump got 85.5% of the vote. Bill Weld came in with 9.1% of the vote, also a former governor of Massachusetts. Anthony, I've got you back. We've got a couple minutes left. What about, I mean, you've spent some time with the Sanders campaign. There has been concern that his voters are less likely to transfer their allegiance to someone else if someone else is the nominee. What have you been hearing?
I know that's a concern. I mean, they're black. I mean, I think I agree with what Mike said. I mean, I think most of them are going to back the nominee. And it's important to point out, and you heard Sanders say this last night, that, you know, he wants to win this, but he's been making it clear in all of his rallies leading up to the New Hampshire primary that whoever wins, you know, this party has to coalesce and come together and vote for the nominee. And he's been telling his followers that for a long, long time. Are all of them going to come out if it's Mike Bloomberg? No, of course not. Probably some will stay home. But, I don't think that that's sort of some kind of virus that has infected all Bernie Sanders supporters, that they're only going to vote Democratic if he's the candidate.
Okay, and Congresswoman Capuano, in our last 30 seconds, how strong a showing do you think we're going to see from Mike Bloomberg when he starts to appear on the ballots?
I think you'll see a strong showing. I have no idea how strong. It'll be a showing, and it could be strong. It's just hard to tell. And again, I think people are still candidate shopping, and I think that might be part of it, too. Even if he does reasonably well, he won't be done March 3rd. He'll be one who'll still be standing almost regardless of how he does.
All right, that's former Massachusetts Congressman Mike Capuano. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks.
Sure, my pleasure.
Hey, I'm Tiziana Deering. Stay tuned. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Local children's book author and illustrator Jan Brett has more than 41 million books in print, including The Mitten, The Hat, and Annie and the Wild Animals. Brett is a Massachusetts native and recently went on a nationwide tour for her new book, The Tale of the Tiger Slippers. And at her first stop in Concord, Massachusetts, kids and parents alike couldn't wait to meet her.
The mermaid one is my favorite, but we can't find Hedgie in it.
I studied her last year in Maryland.
And what happened when you found out you were moving to Massachusetts? What did
that,
you say?
I'm like, oh my gosh, she might be like doing a book thing.
When it blasts up, I like how it has glitter on it.
I'm an art teacher in Lexington.
Oh, are you?
So I'm their mom, and I'm super excited to meet you. These are my twins.
Radio Boston's Chris Siderick caught up with Brett on her tour bus and in the church hall in Concord to find out what she thinks makes a children's book special.
Everything in the cat family is very hard to draw because they're so graceful.
And they always pose himself so beautifully, too. That's the cool thing about him. So he's got the round ears on either side, and the head is massive, and the eyes are somewhat slanted.
That's Jan demonstrating her trademark illustration style at a recent event at the Trinitarian Congregational Church in Concord. Kids and parents alike watch in awe as the blank canvas slowly comes to life. First just a rectangle, then a circle, and before you know it, this colorful, joyful tiger with a sparkle in his eyes smiling back at the crowd. Afterwards, Jan sits at a table signing books and talking with the kids and their parents who've come to meet her and share their joy for her work.
And how about you? What's your favorite animal? A zebra. That is a good one, too. I'm, like, picturing some stories about these creatures. So what do you think of our bus?
This is gorgeous.
Isn't this great? This is a brand new bus.
If you know Jan's books, you know it's the pictures that truly make them come to life. She says that even in kindergarten, she knew she wanted to be a children's book illustrator. But she also says that if she has a gift, it's not actually drawing. It's holding on to her childhood self.
I just love that sense of wonder of, like, jumping out of bed and, like, you know, Mom, you know, can we go outside? Can we do this? Can we do that? And then we go, we'll just wait till 7 o'clock.
Jan's face lit up when she talked about growing up in Hingham. She told me her house felt like Noah's Ark.
Guinea pigs, horses, donkeys, dogs, cats, ducks, chickens. And we loved those animals. And we had this boat, this big sailboat. It wasn't fancy, but everybody could fit. There were three kids, and we could all fit on the boat. Because we'd go way offshore. We'd just see a little bit of blue. That would be land. And my dad was a real old-school kind of sailor. And he never turned the engine on unless it was absolutely necessary.
What does it take to really write and create a classic children's book? What is it that gives those books the lasting power they have?
I tend to like books where the character solves the problem themselves rather than having a rescuer, which traditionally a lot of fairy tales, there's like poof, you know, a rescuer comes and fixes everything, or there's some kind of magic. And I think a little magic goes a long way.
She also said it's important to not assume kids want something overly simple or shallow.
If children don't feel like there is some kind of grit and importance in the writing, they don't know it, but they can feel it, then they will be interested. They'll go on to something else. And it's literature. It's the same kind of rules as the grown-ups have. It has to touch you emotionally. It has to have a character that you care about, a setting that might fascinate you, that you might learn from, or feel like you're an armchair traveler.
Tildy Banker Johnson, the store manager and children's book buyer at Belmont Books, which put on the event with Jan, said that's exactly what she looks for when she's trying to find the next great children's book.
Books that don't condescend to kids, especially the little ones. They're much smarter than a lot of people give them credit for. So they have to have engaging characters and images, the colors, strong lines, that kind of stuff.
Jan's joy and passion for her work are contagious. And the time with her fans clearly means a lot to her.
At the book signing, I don't have very much time with each child, but a lot of times it's a very intense experience. I had this one little boy, and on the front of Goldilocks, there's a Jack in the Pulpit, which is a kind of wildflower that looks like a little stand, a pulpit. And I put a mouse in it, and he said, you know, we have those in our backyard. And his mother said, oh, I don't know if we did. And I said, oh, they grow wild. And then he goes, and he gets this little twinkle in his eye, and he goes, but we don't have a mouse in ours. You know, he totally got it.
Jan's illustrations were the highlight for many in the group gathered at the event.
And then if you leave a little white dot in the eyes, like if you look at my eyes or look at
Jan said she thinks that's because human beings have always communicated visually since the beginning of our history. Even all the way back to the early humans creating cave paintings 40,000 years ago.
Beautiful, exquisite animals and, you know, things that utilitarian objects, but yet they would take the time. And these are people that probably only lived to be 30 before they died. But they would have the time to create something beautiful. Why is that? It's just part of our human constitution of who we are. As we draw, we sing, we, you know, love one another.
That was Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick talking with Massachusetts-based children's author and illustrator Jan Brett. Brett was at the Trinitarian Congregational Church in Concord, Massachusetts, to share some drawing tips and talk about her latest book, The Tale of the Tiger Slippers.